Okay, this is the ninth lecture in the Selected Talks in Meditation, Staying Connected, by Rudolf Steiner. And I've just found that these are, in fact, not complete lectures. And I just like, I guess, to know that on some lecture here that surprised me. I was reading. Here's the overview of the lecture. In the following lectures, Steiner becomes simpler, more direct, and even more concrete. He begins with the assumption that the dead, along with the whole spiritual world, are present and participate in our world. He lays the foundations for an active community of earth and heaven, visible and invisible. First, he affirms that this community, this interpenetration of spiritual and physical, already exists, and has always and has always existed, despite the fact that we are presently unaware of it. In a certain sense, earlier human beings lived much closer to the spiritual worlds than we do. Whereas today we are closer to freedom, our physical organization is coarser and does not allow us, without intentional effort, to think, feel, or perceive to the degree that we could. A side effect of this is that we enter the spiritual world at death with many unfulfilled thoughts, feelings, and perceptions. Previously, human beings passed through the gates of death having accomplished most of what they were supposed to do. Let me read that again. Previously, human beings passed through the gates of death, having accomplished most of what they were supposed to. Not so with us. We arrive with much to do. Above all, we arrive with the freedom to experience certain thoughts, feelings, and perceptions for the first time. This is an incentive to maintain and cultivate a relationship with our dead, so that their unfulfilled thoughts, feelings, and perceptions may pass through our souls into the world. Our task, therefore, is to draw these thoughts into our souls, to open our souls to them. To do this, we must discipline our soul lives so that we may share a common ground with the dead. This means that we must begin to exercise control over our souls so that their natural forces do not dissipate in idle, chattering thoughts, egotistical feelings, and so forth. Above all, we must learn to empty ourselves and to wait for thoughts, insights, feelings to arise from the soul depths where we touch the universal spirit, the cosmic world of thoughts that we share with the dead. Cultivating this inner quiet will help us touch this universal surging sea or web of thought in which we and the earthly world are submerged. If we are able to cultivate the presence of this world within us, we will share a common sphere with the dead that they can enter. Once we become aware of this, we can begin to notice the many other points at which our lives touch this sphere. Chance encounters, synchronicities, and seemingly accidental occurrences begin to indicate another world. Too often we forget to look for the unconscious and unthought in the outer world. In fact, there is an underground thought that encompasses both inner and outer. Becoming aware of this, our lives become richer, wider, deeper. Thereby we come closer to the dead. We learn to unite with them in interest and love. We learn to wait for them to speak. We allow them to complete their lives on earth. This lecture, given on March 5th, 1918 in Berlin, is called Uniting with the Universal Spirit. Ellipsis. From various facts brought before our souls by spiritual science, we know that the human spirit also goes through its own evolution in the course of earthly evolution. We know further that we can know ourselves only if we ask, in a fruitful way, what is our relationship in any incarnation, say our present incarnation, to the spiritual world, to the spiritual realms? That is, what common evolutionary stage has humanity attained at the point when we ourselves live a particular incarnation? We know that a more detailed observation of our common human evolution brings us to the insight that in earlier times and epochs, what we have called atavistic clairvoyance was poured out over humanity, and that the human soul was then, in a certain way, closer to the spiritual worlds. But it was at the same time further from its own freedom, its own free will, while we in our age are closer to freedom, but more shut off from the spiritual worlds. Anyone who knows the real nature of present-day humanity must acknowledge that the old relation to the whole spiritual world persists, unconsciously, in the really spiritual aspects of human beings. People today are generally unable to be consciously aware of it. There are exceptions. In the way that was possible in earlier epochs. If we ask why people can no longer bring this relationship to the spiritual world, into consciousness, by nature, as I said, it is as strong as ever, though in a different mode, we find the reason is that we have passed the midpoint of earthly evolution and are now in a descending current. Our physical organization, though this is not perceptible to external anatomy and physiology, has become more physical, in quotes, than it was, so that during the time we spend between birth, conception, and death, we are no longer organized to bring fully to consciousness our connection with the spiritual world. We must clearly understand that we experience very much more subconsciously than we can generally be conscious of, and the more materialistic we are, the truer this is. The implications of this go even further, and here I come to a very important point in the present development of humanity. At present, generally speaking, human beings cannot think, perceive, or feel all that actually could be thought, perceived, and felt within them. We are gifted for far more intensive thoughts and perceptions than the coarse materiality of our organism allows us to achieve. Consequently, we are not in a position to bring our capacities to complete development during our earthly lives. Whether we die young or old has very little influence on that. Whether young or old, it is the rule that because of the coarse substance of our organisms, we cannot fully accomplish all that we could if our bodies were more finely organized. Thus, whether we are young or old, when we pass through the gate of death, we all leave behind certain unexercised thoughts, feelings, and perceptions. These unprocessed thoughts, feelings, and perceptions are there. And when we pass through the gate of death, whether young or old, we feel an impulse to return to earthly life for further thinking, feeling, and perceiving. Consider some of the implications of this. After death, we become free to form certain thoughts, feelings, and perceptions for the first time. We could have done much more on the earth if we could have fully realized all these thoughts, feelings, and perceptions during our physical lives, but we could not. It is a fact that in our present condition we could do far more on earth than we actually do. In earlier evolutionary times the situation was different. The human organism was finer, a certain consciousness looking into the spiritual world was present, and people could work out of the spirit. During those times people could, as a rule, accomplish everything for which their gifts fitted them. Today, though, we may be proud of our gifts. The facts are as I have described. Since this is so, we can see how necessary it is today that what those who have died carry through the gate of death unprocessed should not be lost to earthly life. The only way to prevent this loss is by cultivating and maintaining a true relationship with the dead. We can do this by making the effort to become fully conscious, under the guidance of spiritual science, of our relationship to those among the dead with whom we are linked by karmic ties. If we do this, the unfulfilled thoughts of the dead pass through our souls into the world, and in this way we can allow these stronger thoughts, which are possible for the dead because they are free from the body, to work in our souls. Though we cannot bring our own thoughts to full development, these thoughts can be effective. We can see from this that the course of events that brought us materialism should make us realize how absolutely necessary it is for us now and in the near future to seek a true relationship with the spirits of the dead. The only question is, how can we draw these thoughts, perceptions, and feelings from the realm of the dead into our own souls? I have already spoken of this from different points of view. In the last lecture, I mentioned two important moments that should be well observed, the moments of going to sleep and of waking up. Today I will describe in greater detail a few things connected with this. The dead cannot enter directly the world we inhabit in our ordinary waking lives, the world that we perceive from outside, that touches our desires and in which we act through our will. Once the dead have passed through the gate of death, they are removed from this world. Yet we can have a world in common with them. If spurred on by spiritual science, we make the effort, which is difficult in our materialistic times, to discipline our thinking and our outer life and not to allow them their customary free course. We can develop certain faculties that give us a common ground with the spirits who have passed through the gate of death. There are, of course, a great many hindrances at this present time to finding this common ground. The first hindrance is that we are, as a rule, too extravagant, too lavish with our thought life. I might even say we are excessive in our thought life. What exactly do I mean by this? Today people live almost exclusively under the influence of the German saying, "Thoughts pay no toll." That is to say, one can allow almost anything to gush out in thoughts. Just remember that speaking is an image of thought life. Consider, therefore, what sort of thought life is involved when people chatter and wander from subject to subject, allowing thoughts to flash up at will. This means that we are squandering the force that gives us thinking. We do this all the time. We are endlessly extravagant, excessive in our thought life. We allow ourselves any thought whatsoever. We want something that pleases us, or we let it go for something else. Let me read that again. We want something that pleases us, or we let it go for something else. In short, we don't want to keep our thoughts under control. How unpleasant it is sometimes when people begin to talk and we listen for a minute or two and then they change the subject. We want to keep to the original topic. Indeed, it may be important. So we have to remind ourselves, what was it we were talking about? Such things happen every day. Just when the talk ought to be serious, we have to struggle to remember how it began. This dissipation of thought force prevents us from receiving the thoughts that come from the depths of soul life and are not our own, but are rather thoughts we have in common with the spiritual realm, the universal ruling spirit. The impulse to fly as we like from thought to thought does not allow us to wait receptively for thoughts to arise from the depths of the soul, to wait for insight, if I may so express it. This attitude, however, is something we need to cultivate, especially in our time. We really need to create the disposition in our soul that allows us to wait watchfully until from far down in the soul thoughts, in the soul, thoughts arise that clearly distinguish themselves as given, not of our own making. We must not suppose that the creation of such a mood can occur overnight. But when we cultivate it, when we really take the trouble simply to be watchful, and having driven out arbitrary thoughts, wait for inspiration, the mood gradually develops. Then it becomes possible to receive thoughts from the depths of the soul, from a wider world than our own ego. If we really develop this capacity, we shall soon see that the world does not consist only of what we see and hear and perceive with our outer senses and the combinations we build up through our reason, but that there is also an objective web of thoughts. Very few people today know this through personal experience. Yet this experience of a universal web of thought within which the soul is actually immersed is not some kind of special occult experience. It is something that all of us can have if we develop the mood I have described. Anyone who has had this experience will express it something like this, quote, "In everyday life, I stand in the world that I perceive with my senses and assemble with the help of my reason. But then I reach a point when it is as if, standing on the shore of sense existence, I plunge into the sea and swim in the surging water. Standing on the shore, I can plunge into the surging sea of thought. Then I am really as though in a surging sea." Unquote. At this point, one has the feeling, or at least the inkling, of a life that is stronger and more intense than the life of dreams. Yet the boundary separating this life from the sense world is similar in kind to the boundary between the sense world and the life of dreams. We can, if we like, refer to such experiences as dreams, but they are not dreams. For the world into which we plunge, this world of surging thoughts that are not our thoughts, but thoughts we are submerged in, is the world out of which our physical sense world arises, out of which it condenses, so to speak. Our physical sense world is like blocks of ice floating in water. The water is all around. The ice congeals and floats in it. Just as the ice consists of the same substance as the water, only it is brought into a different physical condition, so our physical sense world arises from this surging, undulating sea of thought. That is its true origin. Physics speaks of ether, of whirling atoms, only because it does not know of this primordial substance. Shakespeare is nearer to it when he has one of his characters say, in effect, quote, "We are such stuff as dreams are made of," unquote. People give themselves too easily to all kinds of deceptions in this respect. They want to find a crude atomic world behind physical reality, but if we are to speak of anything at all behind physical reality, we must speak of an objective web of thought, an objective thought world. However, we can arrive at this only if we stop letting our thoughts go to waste, and instead develop the mood that comes when we can wait for what is popularly called inspiration. It is not so difficult for those who study spiritual science to develop this mood. The way of thinking that one must develop to do spiritual science leads the soul toward it. When we study spiritual science seriously, we feel the need to develop this intimate web of thought within ourselves. It is this web of thought that provides us with the common sphere where we and the so-called dead are both present, we on one side, they on the other. The web is the common ground where we can meet the dead. The dead cannot enter the world that we perceive with our senses and build up with our reason, but they can enter the world that I have just described. There is a second way to find common ground with the dead. which I spoke of last year. And this was in a set of lectures, GA 179, Historical Necessity and Free Will. Apparently there's a typescript only. And the lectures he's speaking of are December 9th and 10th, 1917. It depends on noticing the end of footnote. It depends on noticing the finer, more intimate connections that arise in our lives. I gave an example to be found in psychological literature. Schubert calls attention to it. Footnote, Gotthilf Heinrich Schubert, 1780 to 1860, doctor and natural scientist, end of footnote. It is taken from old literature, but such examples can still often be found in life. A man was accustomed to taking a certain daily walk. One day, when he reached a certain spot, he had an impulse to step to the side and stand still, and the thought came to him whether it was right to waste time with this walk. At that moment a boulder that had split from the cliff above him fell on the ground, and would certainly have struck him had his thought not caused him to turn aside. This is a crude experience, which anyone would notice if it occurred, but similar experiences of a subtler kind press into our ordinary lives every day. As a rule, we do not notice them. We consider only what actually happens, not what might have happened had it not been averted. We do not reckon with what happens when we are detained at home and go out for a walk a quarter of an hour later than we intended. Often in such cases we would notice something very significant, if only we were ready to reflect how different things would have been if we had not been detained and had left the house a quarter of an hour earlier. Try to observe systematically in your own life what might have happened had you not been delayed a few minutes by somebody coming in, though at the time perhaps you were very angry at being detained. Things are constantly impinging on our lives, perhaps making them turn out differently than they might have, according to our original plans. We seek a quote-unquote causal connection between events in life. We do not reflect upon life with that subtle discernment that would reveal the breaking of a probable chain of events, so that an atmosphere of possibilities continuously surrounds us. If we pay attention to this, then, if we are delayed by 10 minutes in doing something we have been accustomed to do at midday, we will have a feeling that what we do at that time is often, not always, under the influence not just of what happened before, but also of countless other things that have not happened, from which we have been held back. By thinking of what is possible in life, not only in the outer world of sense, we are led to the impression that seeking the connection of what follows with what has gone before is a very one-sided way of looking at life. If we truly ask ourselves such questions, we arouse something within us that would otherwise remain dormant in our mind. We begin, as it were, to read between the lines of life. We come to know life as multifaceted. We come to see ourselves, so to speak, in the midst of our environment, and we see how it forms us and leads us forward incrementally. This is something we usually observe far too little. We consider at most only the inner driving forces that lead us from stage to stage. Let us now consider some simple, ordinary instance that may show how we connect the outer world with our inner being only in a very fragmentary way. Turn your attention to the way you usually become aware of waking in the morning. If you think about it, you will find that you have a very vague notion of how you make yourself get up in the morning. Perhaps even the concept of it is quite nebulous. Try, however, to reflect for a few days in succession on the thought that drives you out of bed. Try to grasp this thought in full clarity. For example, yesterday I got up because I heard the coffee being prepared in the next room. This gave me the impulse to get up. Today it was something else. What was the external cause? This is the point to be quite clear about. Usually we forget to look for ourselves in the outer world. Therefore we find so little of ourselves there. Anyone who gives even a little attention to such things will easily develop a mood that people today have such a holy terror of, I should say an unholy terror, a mood that compels us to realize that there is at least an underground thought at the basis of our life that does not enter our ordinary lives. We enter a room, for instance, or go somewhere, but we seldom ask ourselves how the place changes when we enter it. At times other people may notice or have an idea of this, but even that is not very widespread today. I do not know how many people have any perception of the fact that when a group is in a room, one person is often twice as strongly present as another. One person is strongly there, another weakly. This is something that depends on imponderables. We may easily experience the following. Someone is at a social gathering. He or she enters quietly and glides out again. You have the feeling that an angel flitted in and out. Another person's presence is so powerful that he or she is not present only with two physical feet, as it were, but with all sorts of invisible feet. The other people, however, do not, as a rule, notice this, although it is quite perceptible. the actual individual may not notice it at all. We do not usually hear the undertone arising from the change called forth by our presence. We keep to ourselves and do not inquire of our surroundings what change our presence produces. Yet an inkling of the echo of this presence in our surroundings is something we can come to feel. Just think how our outer lives would gain in intimacy if we not only peopled a place with our presence, but learned to feel how the place was changed by our being there. That is only one example. Similar examples could be drawn from all situations in life. In other words, it is quite possible, not by constantly treading on our own toes, but in a quite healthy way, to become concretely aware of our surroundings, so that we feel the difference we make in them. If we could do this, we would learn to acquire the beginnings of a sensitivity to karma. Indeed, if we could perceive fully what comes about through our deeds or presence, if we always saw the reflection of our own deeds and existence in our surroundings, then we would feel our karma, for karma is woven of this experience. Here I will point only to the enrichment of life that comes from cultivating such intimacies. By learning to read between the lines, we learn to look at life in such a way that we are consciously aware, and aware with our conscience, that we are there. Through this awareness, we do something to create a realm that we can enjoy in common with the dead. And when we develop this inner mood, which looks up to the two pillars I have described, a conscious mode of life and an economical, not extravagant, habit of thought, then we shall achieve what is necessary, now and in the future, for successfully drawing near the dead. If we then form thoughts and connect them with a dead person, aiming not merely at a union of thoughts, but at a union of feeling and interest, if we carry our thoughts further into life situations we shared with that person, so that a tone of feeling plays between us, if we relate our thoughts to occasions when we were concerned with how the person thought, lived, and acted, and with the interest we aroused in him or her, then we can use such occasions to carry the conversation further, as it were. If we then allow these thoughts to rest quietly, so that we pass into a kind of meditation and bring our thoughts, as it were, to the altar of inner spiritual life, then a moment will come when we receive an answer from the dead, when the dead can again reach an understanding with us. We need only build a bridge between the thoughts we unfold toward the dead person and those by which he or she can return to us. For this returning, it will be especially useful to build up in the deepest part of our souls a picture of that individual essential soul being. This is something quite foreign to the present time. For as I have said, people pass one another by, often coming together in the most intimate spheres of life and parting again without knowing one another. This coming to know another person does not depend on analysis. Those who feel themselves being analyzed by someone living with them feel, if they are sensitive, as though they have received a blow. It is of no significance to analyze one another. The best knowledge of another is gained through harmony of heart. There is no need for analysis. I started by saying that the cultivation of relations with the so-called dead is especially needed today, because not from choice, but simply through the evolution of humanity, we live in an epoch of materialism. Because we are not able to cultivate fully all our capacities for thought, feeling, and perception before we die, because something remains undeveloped when we pass through the gate of death, it is necessary for the living to maintain the right connection with the dead, so that ordinary life may be enriched. If only we could bring into human hearts today the fact that life is impoverished when the dead are forgotten. But the right way of thinking about the dead can be developed only by those who are in some way connected with them by karma. When we strive for direct communication with the dead, similar to communication with the living, if we cultivate communication with the dead in this way, the dead are really present, and their thoughts, not completed in their own lifetime, will work into this life. All this certainly makes a very exacting demand on our age. However, if one is convinced by spiritual facts, it must be said that our social, ethical, and religious lives would be endlessly enriched if the living allowed themselves to be advised by the dead. Today, people do not want to consult even those who have reached a mature age. Nowadays, it is thought to be quite right for members of a town or state council to be as young as possible, since at that age, in their own opinion, they are already mature enough for anything. In the days when there was a better knowledge of human nature, a person would have had to reach a certain age before serving on any council. Now people have to wait until others are dead to receive advice from them. Nevertheless, our epoch in particular ought to be willing to heed the counsel of the dead. Improvement will come only when people are willing to listen to their advice. Ellipsis. So, quote-unquote, end of lecture 9.